from Hollywood, it's rated LGBT Radio, starring your host, Rob Watson!
Good evening, wherever you are listening from. This is rated LGBT Radio, and I am Rob Watson. And tonight we have a really interesting show for you. There are several things we're going to be jumping around on. The first of which, and I'm very excited about this, we have author Rick Karatas, and he is going to be telling us about his brand new book, Rainbow Relatives. Rainbow Relatives is a guide for parents, uncles, aunts, teachers, and other trusted adults. On what to say to children about LGBT families and situations. So it's a book that has broad appeal, especially in this day and age, and we are anxious to talk to Rick about his writing of the book, where the ideas came from, and it's filled with anecdotes, so we'll get him to spill a couple of those for us. We are also, in the second half hour, we are going to be talking about conversion therapy. California was landmark in its crackdown on this conversion or reparative therapy, which is therapy where a family or an individual decides that someone's sexual orientation is, quote-unquote, wrong, and they want to change it to be essentially heterosexual. And California was the first in the nation to put a crackdown on that kind of quote-unquote therapy for anybody under 18. Because before that, many teenagers were being forced into it by their parents and harmed in a very big way. California has taken another step, which has, by the way, been renounced by all the major medical and mental health organizations as being dangerous in of itself. And so the California ban that has passed the legislature and is working its way towards the governor's desk would ban that kind of quote-unquote therapy in California altogether. As for me, all for it. So we will discuss that with our journalist experts Brody Levesque and Karen Oakham in the second half hour. We will also be talking and giving tribute to Barbara Bush, who passed away this week, and kind of going over her legacy. She was the second woman in American history to be both First Lady and the mother of a sitting president. And so we'll talk about her. Also, special unannounced treat, since we sent out the promo this morning, memos from Comey have hit the AP, and there's a lot of buzz and discussion going on about them. So we will probably be talking about those two. Again, that will be in our ending half hour. Right now, I want to bring on Brody Levesque, one of our panelists. Brody, good evening.
Hey, Rob. Good evening. How are you?
I'm doing great. So, quite an eventful week.
Quite an eventful week, and today has been kind of an eventful news day, although with this administration, practically every day is eventful. So it's kind of relative, as it were.
It totally is. So right now, you and I are going to kick our feet up and pull up a good book, and we're not going to worry about that for the next half hour. And then we will turn the full door on it. So without further ado, I want to welcome our special guest for the evening, Rick Karatas. Rick, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Oh, thank you.
Can you hear me okay?
For being on.
Oh,
we
okay,
can
good.
Hear you. I'm great.
Okay, good, because I'm outside. I tried to find the quietest spot I could.
Well, you sound completely quiet, and everything sounds really wonderful. So, Rick, first of all, let's go through some of your background, because I know you're a filmmaker and you've written other things. What brought you up to this point where you decided to write this book?
Well, yeah, it's funny. I usually write scripts and songs, and I like writing everything except checks. But my sister kind of gave me this book idea kind of without realizing it. Quite a few years ago, I was talking to her about my nieces and nephews and her kids, and if they knew about my orientation, and they were kind of young, and she's like, I'm not sure. I think so. I'm not sure how to approach that. I wish there was a book on that. So that night I said, let me write. That's a good idea, I think. And I kind of came up with the title, How to Tell the Kids About Uncle Mary and Aunt Butch, but then I realized that was a little too silly. But it finally became Rainbow Relatives. And yeah, so it's the first book I've written, but I've written many scripts. I still need to get many of them made, but they only make remakes and sequels here in Hollywood, so it's a little tough.
or if you happen to have a script based on a comic book, then you're probably in the money. Yeah.
So I do have one film that's not. Oh, sorry. Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead. Sorry.
No, go ahead. No, go ahead.
Oh, no, I just said I do have one film on Amazon Prime now called Walk a Mile in My Prada, so people can check that out if they want.
Yes. Can you tell us a little bit about that? Because I know Tom Arnold stars in that.
Yeah, we have Tom Arnold and Dee Wallace, Mike Starr, Bruce Valanche, and that's kind of like a Freaky Friday with a gay straight twist. About a homophobic construction worker who gets his sexual orientation switched with his coworker 2 weeks before his wedding, thanks to some Christmas magic. So they don't switch bodies, just their sexual orientations get switched 2 weeks before the straight guy's getting married. So, it's kind of a wacky comedy.
it sounds completely worthwhile and fun to check out. So what was your process in, you decided you wanted to write this book, and what did you do next?
Yeah, so it started out being, how to tell nieces and nephews or things like that. So that was the first. And then I tried to think of other subjects. I started interviewing people and doing surveys online about different, subjects like when one parent turns out to be gay, but it's a book for adults, but in speaking to kids. And ironically, it's a lot of times the kids aren't the ones who have the issues, it's the adults. But like your show today with conversion therapy, that's not kids' ideas, that's adults that don't know what they're doing. But I spent a couple years, going back and forth, working on other things and then working on the book. And there's a chapter on, like transgender. So I interviewed a lot of people for that. And it seems like when I would interview someone, they would lead me to someone else. Like even my other sister said, oh, there's a book called Heather Has Two Mommies for kids. So I ended up contacting the author of that book, Leslie Newman, and I got an interview from her. And then I'd interviewed Del Shores, who, did the movie Sordid Lives, and he raised two daughters as a gay dad and did a great job. And he introduced me to a bunch of people and different, like a great organization, Family Equality Council, and someone else introduced me to PFLAG. And so I, got a lot of stories from a lot of these people and great organizations and heard about these great books and movies that I hadn't heard of. And I mentioned a lot of them in the book as well that can help people hopefully have conversations with their kids about some of these subjects. Yeah.
No, that's great. As I was reading the book, I felt in many ways it was almost targeted towards people considering becoming a dad themselves or becoming a mom themselves in a same-sex relationship. Was that your intent, or is this mainly focused for other people talking about those of us who've done that?
I'm not sure if I understand. Like, it's for adults. It could be parents or parents-to-be, or just adults who are in contact with kids. It could be teachers. It could be any adults who have nieces and nephews. So it's meant for anyone that, kids might be asking them questions about things or, there's, like I said, a couple different chapters. There's even a chapter on two moms and two dads. So that's a lot of couples are thinking of becoming fathers and mothers. I'm not sure if that's what you meant or not, but I'm not sure if that answers your question.
Yeah, I was just kind of curious as to who who you were hoping would read the book and get the most out of it. I think you kind of covered it.
Yeah, and I tried to write it so even if people weren't parents, it's an entertaining and educational, and I think it achieves that. You know, it is with a sense of humor in the book a little bit, but there are some serious things like bullying in schools. There's a chapter on that. So, if you're a parent, it definitely will be very helpful. If you're not, I think it's a good read. It's enjoyable. It's being hailed as the biggest book since Fire and Fury by myself, but no, I'm kidding.
Well, wait a minute. I'm kind of detecting a little facetiousness there only because I didn't see Trump tweeting about your book yet. So, you know.
Well, it's not officially out till May 8th. So,
okay.
it's available for pre-order, and we gave you an advance, you know, thing of it. But, yeah, so that's probably why. And I actually tried to I think I only mentioned Trump once in the whole book, and that's when he tweeted about the transgender in the military. But I tried to keep it away from, it's hard to keep totally away from politics, but, you know, and there's a whole chapter on religion, which it's even harder to keep away from politics in that chapter. But that's one of the biggest issues with, you know, families and stuff. Sometimes it's religion or the people who misuse religion to, you know, say bad things about people's families and relatives and stuff. So.
Well, why don't we go there? Because that will dovetail into our later discussion, which unfortunately I know you have a time restraint, so you won't be able to stay on with this. But what did you find the effect of religion on this discussion being? I mean, how did you handle that in the book? And I'm going to dovetail that with there is a recent study out, not that we gay people really needed them to study this, but showing this direct correlation between religious influence and LGBTQ teen suicides. What did you find in the book and how did you treat that?
Yeah, that was the biggest thing because there was actually a Mormon woman who I interviewed and she'd actually helped get like Prop 8 passed kind of. And then she found out her 13-year-old son was gay. And she did a, you know, complete turnaround, and now she's a crusader, you know, for gay rights and stuff. But that's a big thing, like Mormon and Christian. Again, not, and I don't, the book isn't to bash any religions, you know, just the ones that use it. Like, you know, I mentioned Pat Robertson. I used to see him on TV all the time, or still, and he'll say anti-gay things and stuff. So, but then I also interviewed pastors and who are, some of them have, you know, churches that are very accepting. Some of them have even their pastor of a gay church, you know, where mostly gay memberships. So he talks about some of the bad things that are said, but also there's some good things that, you know, there are people that that I interviewed that are doing positive things related to that. But yeah, that's the biggest one because people, you know, people stop talking to there's a guy who wrote a book called Prayer Warriors, and his whole family, you know, practically disowned him, a lot of people go through that. And if you're a teenager hearing all these bad things about gay people and God doesn't like you and all this, that's, I think, the reason they get depressed or, you know, don't feel worthy. And so hopefully this book and other books, obviously, and TV shows now that show a lot of more characters, and I talk about those in the book as well, I think really help so they don't feel as alone and don't feel, you know, that,
In the book, you have different anecdotes of you kind of pose questions or situations, and then you pulled up interviews from different people. And a lot of times, the interviews shared almost differing point of views and recommendations. Did you find yourself needing to be sort of a referee on those and kind of making an overriding recommendation in those cases, or how did you handle that difference of opinion?
Yeah. Sometimes I would give my own opinion, like, because I'm not an expert. This isn't like a book, a scientific book. It's really just stories and advice from people who what they did and what worked for them. And obviously, every family is different. So I try. And yeah, there are some varying. You know, like some people say, you know, kids should be told very young, and the younger the better, and because that way they don't form any pre-conceived can see prejudice. And then there are some people that aren't comfortable with that. They want to wait till they're a little bit older. So it's really up to the person, you know, what they decide. And from reading the book, you know, I do throw my 2 cents in, 3 cents once in a while if I feel it's worth it. But and then some people, if the majority of people are saying something or feel that that works, that might be a way to go. But again, every family, I do have a chapter though where I do interview some therapists and psychologists too to get some expert opinions. But it's, you know, when you're raising kids, it's not all about expert. It's about experience and what people, what worked and what didn't. And so, yeah, so there's.
Right. I know for me, and the one, then you brought this up, the conversation about how, at what age should people tell their children in their family about the other families and whether it's their uncle or their, you know, or whoever, however they know them. And I know from my perspective as a gay dad raising kids, the parents who I guess thought they were going to choose to wait till quote unquote later, actually either it didn't work out that way or it became sort of a problem because, you know, my kids were in their class and in preschool and kindergarten. And so they were already aware that, in my case, Jason and Jesse had two dads. And, you know, so the explanations were being given out, whether that family intended them to or not. So I was interested to see some people, including LGBT people, saying, you know, oh, they would wait till later. And it's like, well, I don't know if that's real world, and, to be honest with
you.
Yeah,
and kids are smart. They figure things out. And you don't have to – you can explain it in age-appropriate ways. You don't have to get into what goes on in the bedroom. The simplest way, a couple of people kind of said it this way, you know, Uncle Bob loves, you know, Ted the way Aunt Sophie loves Margaret. You know, the way your mother loves your father, or, you know, keep it as simple as that. And then as they get older, they ask other questions. So you only need to answer what they're asking there goes an airplane. Sorry. I knew that was going to happen at some point. Anyway, so yeah.
Can
you hear me? Okay?
No, you're fine. What happens, because in that age group, heterosexual and heteronormative relationships are not talked about sexually either. I mean, you're talking about, Cinderella and Sleeping Beauty and all that. And so there really is not a big issue for kids because they're just not thinking that way. I mean, my kids, didn't worry about our sexuality. They just knew they had, these two parents, so there they went. Brody, I think you had a comment on that.
Yeah, Rick, let me jump in here for a sec. Let's take a look at the transgender issue, because at this moment in history, the trans community is very much at the tip of the spear of the weaponry being used by the Christian right and others. Children don't necessarily grasp certain concepts if it is cloaked in religious dogma or theocratic propaganda, or in a lot of cases to do with the trans community, outright lies. As things get misgendered and concepts are taken apart, what did you find and who did you go to get the best explanation for people that have questions about asking about the trans community and explaining this to kids?
Yeah, I did interview a few transgender people, some of them in PFLAG, and their stories and how they came out to their – some of them had kids, obviously, and some had came out later or transitioned later. And that is the hardest one is I think they have a much harder time, transgender people, than gay people. Just it's still more – and that's even – I think he mentioned the suicide rate is even higher for trans teens. So I did talk to several people, and there's one chapter specifically dedicated to that. And a lot of it is I mean, one person explained it like, well, I just like to dress the way I like to dress, and I feel more like a boy than a girl. And there was one great story I love. It's in there with a friend of mine, Marty. She raises her kid, who's 5 or 6 now, just to be very accepting of all people. And, you know, she talks about a transgender boy in her son's school and teaching her kid to be very accepting, which is really good. Because not all parents are do that, you know. And so, but yeah, that's it's a little bit harder, or, you know, because there's more negative things also seen and spoken about. So that one needs a little more talking with kids about. And again, just I think once people get to know, like, I'll be honest with you, I didn't know a lot of transgender people before I started writing the book. So for me, it really helped, and interviewing all the people and getting to know them and realizing certain things that I didn't even realize. And, you know, so like I said, the book is kind of, yeah, go ahead.
Okay, let me interject for just a second here. Besides that issue, there's probably an overlying issue as well. As you start to talk about this book and you start working and doing shows like this, you're going to come into the resistance from the Christian right.
Mm-hmm.
Have you made a game plan for answering the charges? Because you're going to be accused of everything from promoting deviant sex to Satanism,
right,
to, you know, pick a topic and away we go.
Right.
Particularly, you're going to catch heat from places like Dr. Michael Brown, the Heritage Foundation, the Family Research Council, Focus on the Family. Now, these are the leading organizations that are going to be the ones coming after this. I mean, they got all sorts of bent out of shape about, you know, a book about gay penguins. I can only imagine what this one is going to do. How do you plan on answering your critics? Because they're going to get serious, and it's going to get severe.
Yeah, and it's, again, I think that obviously it's you know, in some ways, I'm sure I want to get defensive, and that's probably not good to do. There's a way of answering questions or dealing with them. Some people you're not going to reach no matter what, and they're going to, you kind of just have to say, you're not going to get through to them, and you can kind of, you know, because I definitely think you're right. They will, you know, kind of attack it in some ways, but they're going to attack everything. And I can just say these are just real people and their stories, and they're human beings. And you know, a lot of them will use religion and say, you know, so there's a way to without insulting them back, or, you know, because that doesn't help really. But there's ways of, you bring up a good point. Obviously, I haven't thought too much about that. And I don't, again, in some ways, you can brush certain things off and certain things you have to really address, like you're saying.
Well, then I'm going to give you a suggestion. Probably you should read my Twitter feed, because I am constantly doing battle with the Christian right.
Yeah.
And maybe I can give you a few pointers there. Rob.
Oh, that'd be great. Yeah, that'd be great.
Yeah, you can also look up my blog on Evol Equals, because most of my writing has been directed at individuals in the quote unquote religious right and their specific arguments. But to your point, I always do it. I mean, no offense to Brody. Brody, if we were coupled, he would be bad cop, I'd be good cop. So Brody takes
and
no
don't
part.
Get me wrong, some people should be really told some people should be really told off.
I love how Brody does it, but my piece is just, and I always get accused of being nice. So Rick, tell us, because we only have a few more minutes with you, tell us some of your favorite anecdotes from the book.
Let's see. I don't know if this is answering your question, but there are a lot of, like, uncles were, you know, are hesitant to come out to their nieces and nephews, or their even their parents or whatever. And a lot of times, there was one story of his, one story is funny, of the cell phone picture was on the phone of the kid, and the uncle already knew his brother was gay, but the kid didn't think the father knew, and he was trying to break it to him, and the father made him squirm and stuff. And he said, you know, he said, I saw dad, you know, Uncle Bernie kissing a guy on the phone. And he said, you mean on the cheek? He said, no, on the, on the lips. He goes, are you telling me my brother's gay? And the poor kid is like, you're embarrassed and squirming. And he says, oh, I already knew. And he, they decided to wait to tell the younger sister, which I, again, like more people, I think, would have suggested telling earlier. So there's no secrets in the, you know, for the younger child, I mean, the older child to carry and stuff. I'm not sure if that's answering your question as far as anecdotes, like story, you know.
I also enjoyed the one where the dad had come out to his daughter and they were walking down the beach and he wasn't sure how, you know, how thoroughly she had accepted it or how comfortable she was. And two guys were walking towards them and she said, oh, look, one for you and one for me. And he went, he was kind of like relieved. Oh, great. She's totally on board. This is so cool. And he goes, oh yeah, I'll take the blonde one. And she went, Dad, I meant the surfboards.
Yes.
I thought that
I did try to find a lot of humor in the book because, you know, you have to,
Right. So, Rick, you know, we've only got you for three more minutes. What is your overriding hope that this book will have impact? What impact are you hoping this will impart on our country at this point?
Well, I think it'll just make people more open and accepting of other families, especially I think a lot of people still aren't comfortable with two mom and two dad families. And I think when they read about some of the families in the book, they'll realize they're just like everyone else and they love their kids and they're bringing them up as best they can and doing, you know, it's not about a mother and father and mother. It's just the way you parent and bring up your kids to accept other people. And so that's one of those. And like I said, hopefully it'll reach some of the people it needs to reach. It might change some, you know, some people's way of thinking and stuff and then help others that just don't know how to talk about certain subjects with the kids and stuff. And, I think it'll open up conversations and again, I tried to make it too, where it's not, you know, a scientific kind of a boring book where, you know, cause it's hard to get people to read something like that. So I intentionally made it more of a stories and anecdotes and with humor, and maybe I went too far with it in some spots. I don't know. I'll find out soon enough.
well,
you know,
we'll
I
find
put
out
some stuff out there.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, we'll find
yeah,
out.
I mean,
they,
no matter what you write,
they're
going to...
pitchforks or yeah.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
The book again is called Rainbow Relatives. And Rick, where can people get this on May 8th when it comes out?
Yeah, it officially comes out May 8th, but it's available now on BarnesandNobles.com and Amazon also. And I'm doing a couple book signings coming up in Long Island on May 9th at the Book Review. And Wilmington, Delaware on May 3rd, I think, in Barnes & Noble, and I think May 5th in Rockville, Maryland. But, yeah, so they can go online. My website has info, too, www.rickkaratosh.com, which I should just change to – my legal name is Studi, but I go by Rick. But anyway, so – but, yeah, people can actually pre-order it now and yeah, I hope they enjoy it, and I hope, you know, I hope people, and if Ellen can give out some on her show to the guests, that would be great to get some attention for it.
Well, I want to thank you for coming on with us tonight. It's been great. I hope people check out the book. Very funny stories in it, you guys, and very interesting. You get a lot of different points of view, a lot of experiences. As Rick said, it's for people who know LGBT families, parents, other parents, teachers working with them. I found it valuable for people who are considering having kids. I think it's a good, some thought-provoking things if you're about to embark on a same-sex-led family and adopt kids. So, Rick, any final words?
No, I think so. I really appreciate you having me on the show, and I look forward to you checking out your tweets about that subject. Thank you. I appreciate being on. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, and have a great evening. And we can't wait to see this book climbing the charts. So
okay.
Thank you so much.
All right. Okay. Bye bye.
Well, Rob, while we were on the subject of books, for our listeners, in a couple of weeks, we're going to have Dr. Gabriel Hudson. He's a distinguished professor of all sorts of things in democratic theory and practice, contemporary Western political philosophy and American government. He teaches at George Mason University, the Scarr School of Government in Fairfax, Virginia, which is a suburb of Washington, D.C. Dr. Hudson has written an outstanding book called Christo-Democracy, and he's also been involved in a couple of things near and dear to our hearts in the LGBTQI community. So when we have Dr. Hudson on, I think that'll be a lot of fun. I had a chance to speak to Dr. Hudson this afternoon. He's a very engaging fellow. It'll be a lot of fun. And I think he'll fit really well with you, me, Karen, Dawn, and the whole crew. So with that, I will say, let's talk the news.
why don't we go to the more sentimental story first? We lost First Lady Barbara Bush, and I know you have a lot of pretty direct contact with the Bush family from your vast journalist experience. What are your personal thoughts on Mrs. Bush?
I think that the passage of the First Lady, quite frankly, is really, really sad. You know, in a lot of ways, the Bush family is, if you will, the political right version of the Kennedy family. It's a dynasty. It's old school. And the thing about Mrs. Bush was that she was always such a presence. She was very witty. She was very direct. Surprisingly enough, she held forth opinions and had strong, strong leanings in areas that most people wouldn't have expected. For example, the former First Lady was very much pro-choice for women, which, of course, is polar opposite to the policies espoused by her husband's administration and that Republican Party. And then, of course, her son, President Bush, 43, as the family labels them 41 and 43, George W. Bush. The other thing about Mrs. Bush was she really pushed extremely hard to increase literacy. And the thing that I think is the most important thing was that Mrs. Bush really, for the first time, put a human face on the HIV and AIDS epidemic at a time when that wasn't a very popular thing to do, particularly not, okay, by the wife of a sitting Republican president. And this is coming off the heels of 8 years of the Reagan administration. And, of course, during those 8 years, the LGBTQI community and anyone afflicted with AIDS was marginalized and, quite frankly, demonized by that administration. So for me, you know, there are going to be people that are disagreed, but the thing is, everything was incremental. And I've always maintained that when someone like Mrs. Bush was able to do that, it made a statement. And the most important thing was, is maybe she wasn't completely able, okay, to get, you know, the kids into it and to get the, you know, the people around her husband's administration to see it her way, but her influences were felt in future generations, particularly with the grandkids. So, you know, it's one of these things where, and she was just class. I had dealt with the First Lady several times, and I got to be honest with you, I love Mrs. Bush. I just thought she was great.
I think that's really wonderful, and I love what you were saying about comparing it to the Kennedy dynasty, because I think there was sort of a parallel between Rose Kennedy and Barbara Bush, in that of all the figures on the whole political landscape over the several last decades, they stand out not only as being political wives, but more importantly, the matriarchs above a president or a presidential potential family, and almost like the puppet masters, if you will, in a matriarchal sense. So I think you're right in that. I do want to take a second here to welcome
Karen Oakham, our esteemed journalist friend and colleague, onto the show. Welcome, Karen.
Hey there. So thank you for bringing me on at this hour. I was watching Rachel Maddow's live interview with James Comey and then follow-up analysis, which was all very interesting, especially since it was happening just as the memos were being released. So I don't know if you've talked about that yet.
We are going to touch on that in a few minutes. Before we go there, though, I just want to get any thoughts you have about the passing of Barbara Bush.
Well, I thought that she was an extraordinary woman. She was very feisty, and I like that. I appreciated the fact that she, she took time out to, in 1989, I believe it was, to go to a shelter where there were orphans of babies with AIDS who were essentially, you know, there to die. And she cradled them. And I'm actually doing an AIDS timeline. And I found out in the process of going over some other stuff that the following year or 1991, when George Herbert Walker Bush and Barbara Bush went to London, that Barbara Bush actually asked Princess Diana to go visit a shelter with people with AIDS as well, which it's not, you know, again, you have to, I believe Brody's talked about this, but, you know, remember at this time, there were people who thought that AIDS could be, you could be infected through the air, you know, like tuberculosis or something. So it was very powerful. And so while, while Bush, President Bush was meeting with with Thatcher, the prime minister, Princess Diana had done something similar, opening an AIDS hospital in London, and there were like 12 beds there, and nine of the people, HIV patients, they introduced themselves to her, but they disappeared so the media wouldn't see them, because the British tabloids, as you know, were just horrendous. I mean, we had our, you know, we have Jesse Helms and all sorts of other religious people saying AIDS was God's punishment. So it was a very big deal. And the fact that Princess Diana and Barbara Bush did this at the same time, but independently of each other, was really quite powerful and said something about strong women. So, I want to take note of that. And then, of course, the letter that she sent to the president of PFLAG at the time, also in 1989. I lost so many friends, to tell you the truth, that for, as much applause as I give her for hugging, people with AIDS, I just wish that she had done more publicly. I understand from Brody and other people that she did a lot behind the scenes, but that's me and my PTSD over AIDS. I wish she had done more during that time.
I hear you on that, because I have to say, and Brody, you can definitely weigh in on this, but I have sort of this two mind thing over the paradox of the whole Bush plan and our experience with them over their various presidencies, where there seems to be this private supportiveness. I mean, after George W. left office, Laura Bush and the daughters and everybody came out to be very pro-equality, same-sex marriage and all this, and yet George W. Bush ran under the Karl Rove strategy of absolutely decimating the country with, the anti-marriage amendments and all that sort of stuff. I mean, it was a whole political strategy on his part. And his father, where certainly he improved over Ronald Reagan, which was not a huge leap to do that. Still, it was sort of smoke and mirrors where the funding was mostly Social Security for people who were on disability through AIDS.
That's a very important point, though, and that ought not to be dismissed, because the Americans with Disabilities Act was a very, very big deal, and to have HIV/AIDS included in that. And by the way, the disability community, whenever, you know, the Republicans in Congress, this is actually Ted Kennedy and Orrin Hatch were promoting this in the Senate. And, you know, when the Jesse Helms types tried to get AIDS written out of it, the entire disability community stood with people with AIDS. They were kind of like the Marines. We're not leaving anyone behind.
Right.
So there was that kind of impact that was brought to Herbert Walker Bush, who signed, the ADA. But to your earlier point, there's this kind of, you know, old establishment patrician Republican thing that abortion and homosexuality were private matters. You know, you don't speak publicly about anything that has anything to do with sex. So the fact that all this was discussed behind the scenes is kind of de rigueur for that kind of, I don't want to say ilk, but, you know, social status, if you will. That was a whole thing. So I understand that, but at the same time, when you're having people dying, it's just like abortions, you know, people dying, bleeding out on abortion, you know, from botched abortions. People were dying. That's why Roe v. Wade came up. There was an urgency to it, you know, and
right.
And same thing with people with AIDS. So it's like silence equals death. That was a very impactful thing that ACT UP did, not only giving permission for people to come out as being possible and positive and showing the visibility and talking about it, but demanding it, because if you don't come out and talk about it, then you're in the closet, you die alone, you die. Nobody knows that this is happening, and hence nothing can be changed public policy-wise. By the time
right.
we got to Bush, that had already happened. So that's
right.
what
and
I'm talking
yeah, that is, yeah, that had happened, and your point on the Americans with Disabilities is very valid. But when you consider how other presidents respond to, like, swine flu and all these things that
Legionnaire's,
you know,
disease
taken
at the same time.
Five,
exactly.
And the, so it's sort of a glass half full, half empty kind of scenario. Mm-hmm. I need to move on, though, so we can cover some of our other subjects. So definitely we want to honor Mrs. Bush in the best way for what she did do and
mm-hmm.
the class she brought to, especially given the current political climate of the class
mm-hmm.
that she brought to the
yeah.
scene. But switching gears to California, Karen, you're in my backyard. California is pushing towards a complete ban on quote-unquote conversion therapy and reparative therapy. Complete misnomers. What do you think about that?
Well, I think it's about time. It's going to be an interesting debate because, once again, the religious right folks are claiming that this is a religious liberties issue. Let's set out what it is. Already, there is a law in California that says, and Jerry Brown, Governor Jerry Brown, has called this so-called conversion therapy junk science. And there is a law against licensed psychologists or psychiatrists using this to lure parents and convince parents that their children can be changed from gay to straight or LGBT of any fashion to straight. And Ted Lieu, who authored the original bill, called it psychological abuse, emotional and psychological abuse. So this latest version, what's up with this latest version, is that it's applying to adults. And what they're doing is they're extrapolating out, saying, okay, we've already established that this is junk science. So anybody who is advertising for this junk science and trying to convince adults to do this, that they can change, that that's fraud. And that these
right.
are purveyors of fraud, and therefore they can't do it. So that's the tactic that's being taken. The religious right is looking at them and going and saying, well, wait a second, what about freedom of speech? What about religious liberties? If my religion says, that homosexuality is an abomination, and I have a religious person coming to talk to me as a licensed counselor, surely I should be able to talk to them about how they can change. And why should I not be able to advertise that that's part of the counseling that I give? It's kind of like these abortion, anti-abortion clinics that are set up right next to Planned Parenthood that claim that they give family counseling, and what they're really about is talking somebody out of an abortion. So
right.
That's what's up now. It just passed the California Assembly. It goes to the Senate. And Jerry Brown is likely to sign it.
Brody,
that's happening in
the state. What do you see on this? And do you think there is going to be kind of a backlash from the religious freedom? Will this give them actually some fuel to their quote-unquote cause?
There's a couple of things here. Assemblyman Evan Lowe, who's the bill's author, explained on a speech he gave on the assembly floor that this actual law is specifically targeting reparative therapy as a deceptive business practice. And, as the assemblyman said, he had gone through conversion therapy and had suffered, depression and a bunch of other things. And the assemblyman insisted that this bill is only going to be involving efforts that involve the exchange of money. Now, that's really critically important because the way that the conversation is being framed by the Christian right is that this is a must-stay gay bill and that it's going to impede religious freedom and all this other nonsense. The religious right has grabbed up this phrase that they're using now. They call it talk therapy. That's what they're actually calling it now, because conversion therapy or reparative therapy has suddenly become radioactive. So the latest ploy is to call it talk therapy, and they frame it as consulting by religious, types and churches and things like that. So what this essentially does, and what Assemblyman Lowe's bill will do, is it's going to cut off any clinic or any practicing professional. Okay, and it does not touch the churches. And see, this is where in other states, I'm not sure about California, but in other states like Oklahoma, for example, about 85 to 90% of the so-called talk therapy, as they're calling it now, actually occurs within the environment of church counseling. So for the religious right to sit there and say, well, this is impugning our religious freedoms and all this other stuff, no, it's not. Reparative therapy,
right.
conversion therapy has already been deemed harmful practice. All the state of California
right.
is doing is saying it's a deceptive business practice. You can't pay someone. You can't take money from someone. And that's the end of it. But that's not how the religious right is seeing it.
Well, I'm all for it. And it's about time. And I'm proud of California for taking a leadership role in this yet again. As we have in other areas of LGBT progress. I want to switch, though, because we're down to our last 10 minutes, and I know you both are chomping at the bit to go into this. I just feel it. So apparently there were some Comey memos that hit AP. So Brody, I'll start with you and then Karen. What's in these memos that are coming out?
Oh, these things are just, oh, they're rich. They're great. About 2 hours ago, the Associated Press released the Comey memos. And the portrait, these are the actual narrative when Director Comey was giving his testimony to Congress. He referred to it. He would have a meeting. For example, one memo, I believe, was January 7th. And in there, it's meeting with PE, which is shorthand for President-elect. And he details all these conversations. He details his being so uncomfortable with the president because he was, like, touching him and in his face, and almost like a mafia don. As a matter of fact, I think in one memo, he actually made that analogy. At another point, he told Comey that the president of the Russian Federation told him that Russia had the most beautiful female hookers. It's these type of things. I mean, there's a lot of, quite frankly, salacious detail in there that you would never honestly truly expect, okay, from a sitting president. Now, unfortunately, I wasn't able to watch our colleague and peer Rachel Maddow's interview with Director Comey, but I'm going to let Karen talk about that because I'm almost sure that Rachel probably had the things printed out in front of her and was asking the director about these things.
Well,
so, Karen,
and that's
what,
right.
What
I mean, they were they came out just as she started her interview, so she had not read them in advance. I mean, they had producers backstage who were reading and trying to find, some of the information. And some, I really suggest that, people go online and watch the whole interview because a lot of it was Rachel explaining things and trying to get Comey to respond. And he'd say, well, something to the effect of, I take your point, but I really can't respond to that. I'm not allowed to respond to that, which just in him saying I'm not allowed to, in and of itself, lent credibility to what she was asking about. The key takeaways, there were a couple of key takeaways, primarily the consistency. So we have now three different telling of the story. We have Comey saying what he said in his congressional testimony. We have the memos that, by the way, are part of an ongoing investigation. So the House Republicans forced Rosenstein to release these memos. He did, which is unprecedented. And then shortly after they were given over to the House Republicans, they were leaked. Because the House Republicans, have a whole different other version than almost everybody else. But anyway, so you have Comey's testimony, you have the memos, and then you have the contemporaneous notes taken by the people Comey talked to. Because his original memo was sent out as an email to his colleagues, and then there are follow-up memos with other conversations. But both McCabe and another deputy director have both said, using similar language and phrasing, actually, and this was all contemporaneous. So the fact that there are three different kind of pieces of evidence, if you will, that are contemporaneous about what Comey said really lends to his credibility. What's going to happen with that in court? I don't know.
So, to your point, the Republican, somebody in the Republican camp is the one that leaked them. What is their motivation for leaking these?
Yeah, because the Comey memos are part of an ongoing, FBI federal investigation. You do not leak material that is part of a federal investigation. But Devin Nunes, all these guys, insisted on having, they have the right to see these memos, and Trey Gowdy is already out saying, see, it proves this, that, and the other, and, no, it doesn't prove what he says it does. It proves the consistency. So for the majority of people, I would suggest the release of the memos, which is unprecedented, is actually going to backfire because it supports, they all go to support Comey's, you know, version of what happened. One other thing that I do want to point out about the interview with Comey that was interesting was that Rachel also raised the point that Rudy Giuliani is now, you know, has been hired by Trump to work in his team. And Rudy Giuliani has basically proven, said that, you know, he's going to end the investigation in another 2 weeks. Well, Comey said, you know, Comey's had dealings with Rudy Giuliani himself and basically calls him a bully, and said that after Giuliani went on Fox and Friends during the campaign in October and announced the October surprise regarding the investigation, the FBI investigation into the Clinton email, that Comey started an investigation about those leaks. How did Rudy Giuliani know that? How did the Trump campaign know that those Clinton emails were going to be released and under investigation? So he said he got fired before he found out the results of that investigation. But you know, our dogged press here is going to be following after that. And one other thing that's in the memos that I think for us is very important is that Trump jokingly, during that dinner conversation, talked about jailing reporters for leaks, and that
sure,
a couple of days in jail makes them talk. He was talking about Judy Miller and the Scooter Libby thing. So that's very concerning. But that's also in the memos and may not get as much play. So those are just off the top of my head.
Yeah, the Giuliani thing is actually concerning, that his goal to end the investigation in a few weeks is, oh my God,
how is he going to do that?
Well, yeah,
but how is he going to do that? He said he's going to negotiate the end.
Which means if you, So big issues there. Brody, final words from you on this and what's coming up.
Yeah, tomorrow is a sad anniversary for me personally. 19 years ago at 11:19 a.m. Mountain Standard Time, two students commenced killing peers and classmates at Columbine High School in Littleton, Colorado. It ended, of course, at 12:08 p.m. with the suicide of the two shooters. I was on a plane to Denver within probably 6 or 7 hours after the initial reports, and then spent the next 2 or 3 days in Littleton. Tomorrow is the national walkout, which has been organized by David Hogg and Cameron Kapaski and Lauren Hogg and Emma for Change. Of course, the March for Our Lives and Brandon J. Wolf, our friend. And the kids of high schools all over the United States will be leaving and walking out of their high schools in remembrance of this. And again, like I said, it is the 19th anniversary of the shooting at Columbine High School in Littleton, Colorado.
So we will be paying close attention to that. And, you know, Columbine, and not all that much has changed in terms of public policy, which is horrendous. So my faith is in these young people to turn that around. You have been listening to Rated LGBT Radio. We will be back again next week with my panel of experts and exciting guests. Also, listen to Out in Santa Cruz Saturday night, 7 p.m. Pacific Time, www.ksco.com. For Brody, Karen, and myself, and thanks out to our guest, Rick. We want to bid you good night and come back next week again. We will have a great show for you as well then.
You've been listening to Rated LGBT Radio.